Today on Penn's Exchange, the Medieval Constitution of Liberty. Welcome to Penn's Exchange, the forum where we discuss everything related to the historical experience of markets and their philosophical foundations. Today we will be joined by Alexander Salter. He's the George G. Snyder Associate Professor of Economics in the Rawls College of Business at Texas Tech University. He's also the Comparative Economics Research Fellow at TDU's Free Market Institute. His research focuses on comparative political economy and institutional analysis. His interests include the economics of governance in the tradition of the Virginia School of Political Economy, investigating which governance rules effectively align the incentives of governors with the welfare of the governed. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you, Fernando. I'm looking forward to this.
The Great Enrichment is one of the most important events in human history, and it started in Europe in the 17th to 19th centuries. Many ink has been shed trying to explain why. Today, Dr. Salter will discuss his latest book, co-authored with Professor Andrew Young, titled The Medieval Constitution of Liberty, Political Foundations of Liberalism in the West. In this work, they contend Western exceptionalism finds its roots in the intricate and fragmented political structures of medieval Europe. This setting laid the groundwork for effective governance that fostered wealth generation. So, Alex, to begin, I would like to inquire broadly about the title of the book and its significance. As stated in the introduction, the title pays tribute to Hayek's renowned work, The Constitution of Liberty. So what exactly does that entail? What is a Constitution of Liberty?
Great place to start. The way that Hayek thought about it was that a Constitution of Liberty ultimately restrained the state's use of coercion to enforcing general and predictable rules that was not a regarder of persons. This idea that publicly sanctioned violence to maintain peace, uphold the rule of law, would be used only in general and predictable ways. Hayek himself noted in that book that what we think of as modern liberty is actually the descendant of medieval liberties, plural. So there's a bit of a paradox here. Since what I just described to you, if you know anything about medieval Europe, is not at all how medieval Europe functioned. Their law was primarily a function of group status, membership in some tribe, ethnic group, according to other membership in other corporations and or status within the church, for example. But nonetheless, although there was a notable difference between liberties and liberty, the existence of liberties, charters of immunity, specific privileges, these things were part of the historical evolution of political institutions that eventually culminated in modern post-Enlightenment political liberty. That's why we subtitled the book, The Political Foundations of Liberalism in the West, because we ultimately see ourselves contributing to the conversation about where liberalism came from.
Before delving further into the historical argument, because the first chapters are very much focused on that, I would like to explore your economic framework, because I think that's the value added of the book. You introduced this term, polycentric sovereignty, to describe this political medieval landscape. Could you elaborate a little bit on what that entails?
Certainly. I'm sure many of your listeners will already be familiar with the idea of polycentricity, since it's a pretty standard concept in the economics of governance literature. Polycentricity means that within a given geographic territory, authority to make collective action decisions is overlapping, fractured, and concurrent. This idea that there is no monopoly on the provision of governance rules or the use of force. These things are divided amongst various governance providers whose authority within a given territorial jurisdiction often does overlap. Sovereignty is a little bit more of an esoteric concept since we are using it in an idiosyncratic way. You usually hear about theories of sovereignty in political philosophy, who ought to rule. That's the question that theories of sovereignty purport to answer. We take an economic perspective on sovereignty. We link it to this idea in the book of political property rights. One thing that's really interesting about the Middle Ages is that political authority, the right to govern, in many ways was a privately owned and tradable asset. And so we conceive of political property rights as existing within a hierarchy, and at some point in that hierarchy, because there is no nation state, there is no monopoly enforcer, political property rights have to be self-enforced. And that's exactly what we refer to as sovereignty, self-enforcement of political property rights. So if you put policentricity and sovereignty closer together, what you have is a network of political elites, governance providers, who in some meaningful sense own the means of governance, interacting with each other and enforcing their own rights claims. So the only sustainable distribution of political power has to be rooted in agreement. That's what we mean by polycentric sovereignty.
Another term that you introduce is that of the shareholding state. So as a pertinent constitutionally ideal type, distinct from the conventional democracy-autocracy dichotomy that we often find discussing in political science, could you provide a little bit more insight into why this notion of the shareholder state is relevant?
Yes, we introduced the idea of a shareholder state as another way of thinking about political constitutions in a basic sense, other than the standard spectrum from democracy to autocracy, as you mentioned. The key difference with the shareholder state is, again, the people who are making the decisions that affect the community are themselves, in a meaningful sense, residual claimants to the governance decisions that are being made. There's something connecting personal power over political outcomes with revenues generated within the territory, some measure of aligning incentives. And we contrast it with democracy, when there isn't really any meaningful sense of residual claimancy, but decisions are maximally inclusive, with autocracy, in which case there's one residual claimant. Obviously, residual claimancy there would be very strong, but the autocrat does not have very much incentive to take into account the harm that he does to his subjects, citizens, other than through the wealth that his citizens create for him. So one way of thinking about that, for example, is that a rancher has a certain incentive to take care of his cattle, but we all know where the cattle are going to end up. So it's not necessarily great for the cattle. Obviously, we care much more about people than cattle, so we don't want to necessarily say, well, an autocrat will necessarily govern well because he privately owns the territory. Mansur Olson has a famous American political science paper, 1993, I believe, where he famously writes against that argument and shows why it's wrong.
If I am correct, then your argument is that you want to introduce the idea that the medieval foundations are relevant to understand the modern state, and that the shareholder state of the medieval period is basically maybe has been not understudied in the literature at best, and it should be put more attention into that. Is that correct?
We definitely agree with that. What we see our book is doing is offering a positive theory of long-term constitutional bargaining. Constitutional here meaning pertaining to the basic decision-making features of government, however you want to define a government. Maybe it's a nice, well-behaved nation-state, post-Enlightenment, post-Renaissance. Maybe it's decentralized nobles, bishops, burghers providing something according to medieval, to the standards of medieval Europe. But ultimately, we need to understand where contemporary nation states came from, and we need to understand the bargaining process that yielded that, going all the way back to, frankly, the fall of Rome, really looking at the 4th, 5th, and early 6th centuries AD. So we think that medieval Europe has been underemphasized precisely because we're not studying the positive constitutional bargaining process going back far. There's things happening in medieval Europe, specifically the High Middle Ages. The 1200s are particularly important, without which we cannot understand even Renaissance developments and the developments of early modernity. Now, of course, you could also say, well, why stop there? Why not go back even further? Why not go back to Rome? Why not go back before what came Rome? At a certain sense, everything is endogenous. You have to start somewhere to tell a coherent story. And we think for the purposes of the story that we want to tell, and again, remember, the question that we're interested in is, where did the great enrichment come from? And ultimately, where did liberalism come from? That this is an important and neglected starting point that we think that we need to bring to the table of scholarly conversations to fully understand these periods.
So yes, let's talk a little bit about the history, because the first part of your book is all about trying to understand the details of basically the fall of Rome, the union between the Roman legacy of law and institutions with that of the gods and the other Germanic tribes. So I understand that everything is endogenous, but nonetheless, I want to push back. Right? Why this period? What is special about the early medieval period? What the Carolingian dynasty, for example? You start with that. You said, well, the Merovingians were already there, but really what we are interested in is the Carolingians. So what is special about them?
We think the Carolingian period has been understudied precisely because that's what gave rise to these medieval institutions that we think are very important for explaining subsequent liberty. Later on in the book, we'll go into the medieval representative assembly and the free city, the free commercial city. I don't want to talk too much about that now. But we study the Carolingian period precisely because it gives us this really great laboratory for actually seeing state building real time, understanding the process of the constitutional exchanges whereby the various elites who had de facto political authority, de facto political control, got together with other elites. Sometimes they are cooperating with them, sometimes they are competing with them. Burghers getting together with feudal lords, military leaders getting together with often bishops. Let's not forget that bishops often own significant territory in this time period, and especially in the Eastern Holy Roman Empire, the Eastern Carolingian domains, it was not at all uncommon for bishops to be able to put armies in the field. So clearly their buy-in to whatever governance innovations we see over these long centuries is relevant to understanding the shareholder state bargaining process. What we're looking at is the exchanges of political authority amongst political elites that actually gave us a de facto constitution that would eventually allow for responsible state building. So we're getting into also later on early modernity and the Renaissance as well. But the point is, we don't think that we can actually understand coherent state building starting in the middle of the 16th century unless we understand the backdrop, the endowment of political property rights, so to speak, against which those political exchanges take place. It's also worth noting that not a lot of people talk about the Carolingian Empire in terms of economic history and the Great Enrichment. If you look at the literature, England and Holland are much more studied for obvious reasons. That's where the commercial takeoff happened. So you're going to want to pay a lot of attention to those time periods. We think that going back to the Carolingian Empire is going to add some context for even those instances of state building that we need to take cognizance of.
So yeah, related to that, given that you focus very much on the Frankish territories, which encompass most of Western Europe, but not all of it, then how do you basically reconcile this idea that the Western exceptionalism is Frankish and not English? Of course, we may doubt that it's Southern Italian or Spaniard, because that's not where the Great Enrichment started. But what about England?
Yes, that's right. And we do talk about England in the book a little bit when we actually get into medieval representative assemblies. In fact, there are English innovations that we think are particularly important since England's representative assembly was territorially based. And we contrast that with the French assembly, which was estates-based. And we think the properties of collective action there are going to be very different and will predictably produce very different governance outcomes. But again, ultimately, what we think we need to focus on is what is it that ensured over the long course of centuries over which these constitutional exchanges take place that the political elites were making decisions that also benefited people who were not privileged enough to have a seat at the table. We can understand why lords and burghers and bishops made bargains that benefited themselves. What about the great mass of people who weren't formally included in these deliberations? What about the rise of representative institutions? What about the rise of chartered immunities and liberties? What about the rise of the rule of law? How did these things happen? We need to be able to explain this as the outcome of a bargaining process. And we think it makes sense to say that the parties to that bargaining process are going to be political elites. They have the power, they have the resources, and they're going to be largely self-interested. We're not comfortable appealing to altruism as an explanation for why we got governance rules that were ultimately productive and protective rather than predatory. And so the reason that we take on the Carolingian aspect so much is really because it's kind of a hard case. You have a large territorial empire. You would expect that political authority to be wielded in ways that are not so nice for the vast majority of people involved. So if we can find a way of classifying the governance innovations as unintendedly beneficial, even for those people who were not powerful enough to be formally included in political deliberations, we think that that's a pretty important story, historically considered.
I would also like to ask about the role of the Catholic Church, because, of course, you talk a lot about it within the book, but from my reading of it, you seem to think that it's just kind of a layer within the overall framework rather than the catalyst. I've read a lot of books kind of talking about the point that maybe the Catholic Church was a sine qua non condition for the Great Enrichment. But you think that is true, or do you think that it's just one cog in the wheel of the machinery that you're trying to explain?
That is a great question. It is absolutely true that in the book, we see the Catholic Church as one institution among many in the process. We weren't comfortable saying that there was anything unique about Catholicism or Christianity that led to this process simply because we didn't know how to make the argument. I will say that in my individual and or private capacity, I do think that there is a lot to the argument that the Catholic Church was not just one institution among many, but was a necessary ingredient. You could make a very strong argument that changes in norms regarding personhood that were fostered by Christianity were important. That does seem to be something that was widely embedded in law. So what we wanted to do with the book was take a more minimalist approach, for lack of a better word, and treat the Catholic Church as one institution among many that sort of provided a transnational source of moral authority, and that was also a player at the was also a political player who had a seat at the shareholders' table. Again, privately, I am a practicing Christian. I'm very comfortable and enthusiastic about the idea that there's something unique and special about Christianity that gave rise to modern notions of human dignity and human rights. But for the purposes of this book, we found it prudent to rely primarily on institutional mechanisms and institutional explanations.
So one chapter of your book focuses basically on trying to explain why did not the Great Enlightenment happen in other parts. Now that we're talking about Christianity and you focus very much on Western Europe, so would you say the main difference between Eastern Europe and Western Europe is this kind of change in basically Orthodox and Catholics, or would you say there's something else besides that?
That's a fascinating question. I don't know enough about Eastern Europe during this time period to really understand the contrast between the institutional structures as a very deep level. I have a surface level understanding, which leads me to conclude that political authority was much more centralized, less fragmented. And I think that that's going to be one of the reasons why you don't see that kind of political development and political authority being allocated in the way necessary to get broad-based economic growth. It's a similar kind of question to if the Roman Empire was so good at providing law and order, why no Industrial Revolution then? Again, I'm not an expert in Eastern Europe over this time period, however, so I couldn't really make the comparison. In the book, we actually spend a lot more time talking about Western Europe versus other places that plausibly could have seen a great enrichment, like China. We even have an entire section of the book on why not China, since China at this time also had a high civilization, significant intellectual and cultural sophistication, extensive trade. There's a way of looking at their laws and institutions as friendly to commerce. And in fact, during most of this time, China was arguably the leading civilization in the world, while Europe was still coming out of a rather unfortunate period coming into the High Middle Ages. So the question of why Europe, Western Europe, and not China is one of the more interesting questions that we take on. And I think that on that specific issue, our interpretations actually accord with the, if not the majority, then the plurality of practicing economic historians today.
So there are two institutions that you highlight as crucial for understanding the Western European medieval constitution of liberty, which you already talked a little bit about them, which are representative assemblies and self-governing cities. Could you actually talk a little bit more about them, why these are important?
I'm excited to talk about these. This is probably my favorite part of the book. We see these two institutions as very important for the rise of liberty in general, and of course, the notion of commercial flourishing and economic growth that we frankly take for granted today. Representative assemblies are important because if you have elites getting together to bargain, to exchange political authority, formalizing that process is important for lowering transaction costs, establishing credible commitments, and doing all the various things that you need to make these agreements sustainable, given that there's no third-party enforcer. Nation states were dealing with various elites, most of whom could credibly marshal force, including lethal force. And so if you had anything happen and it was sustainable and equitable, it had to rely on agreement. In the chapter on medieval representative assemblies, again, we contrast England's, which was territorially based, with France's, which was estates-based. And we think that that's important because the nature of the agreements is going to change. If you have territorially based assemblies, you have a mixing of interest groups, elites, commoners, within a given chamber of the representative assembly. So you have to get bargains that are good both for the common man and for the elites before they make it out of the chamber. And in an estates-based system, of course, you can have the nobility team up with the church to at the expense of the third estate, the common people. And so that's going to be a predictable difference in what actually comes out of the collective bargaining process. Understanding that the association of interests and placing of interests, whether they're co-mingled within the same representative chamber or assembly, or whether they're actually segmented by chambers or assemblies, is going to change the nature of the transaction cost minimizing bargains to political exchange. The section on free cities we talk about is important because obviously there's a lot of commercial developments that are very important to that. The towns of the Hanseatic League, the recovery of the international law merchant. Oftentimes cities had special privileges and immunities from local political authorities like kings. They basically could govern themselves in exchange for a fraction of tax revenues. And that provided significant avenues for experimentation, for innovation, both in commercial law and in basic political law as well. And so insofar as you actually need that institutional innovation to undergird the Great Enlightenment, we don't think that you would have gotten it without the medieval cities. We also talk about cities because we think it's important to discuss why we disagree with other prominent economic historians. In this case, we're focusing on Deirdre McCloskey, who has moved away from institutional explanations for the Great Enrichment. In fact, the Great Enrichment is Deirdre's term, and talks about a change in culture, a change in norms, a change in dignity. Again, I and my co-author are very sympathetic to that. We think it's important to note, however, that there are institutional prerequisites. There needs to be a basic setup and the rules of the game before we can get the widespread recognition of dignity and honor and letting common people have a go, in McCloskey's expression. So we think that there are things that need to happen socially and politically before we can get that sort of cultural change. And so we want to provide a theory that basically gets the rules of the game right first before we talk about things that we think are more downstream, like cultural change.
So now that we are talking about disagreements with the economics and the economic historians, so I would like to talk a little bit about that. So you conclude the book with a brief discussion in a couple of chapters that I think are the most contentious aspect of the work, which is basically your discourse on the state capacity literature, which is huge and has been huge for at least a couple of decades now. So I must say that there are a couple of books already and a lot of texts that maybe not identical to your argument, but they share similarities in the sense that they highlight Western exceptionalism through these layered governance systems that provide more or less the necessary incentives for wealth generation. Depends who you ask, when it started and when it started, basically. However, they often portray the medieval world as this transitional phase, with the ultimate outcome being the emergence of a strong liberal state, that is, of course, a centralized, powerful state that is nonetheless constrained by this constitution. You, however, have a dimmer view on the modern state, and I think that's what's special about your book. So could you talk a little bit why? What's special about the medieval world compared to the modern?
I'm very excited to talk about this because this is undoubtedly where we get the most pushback, and that makes this talking about this part of the book the most fun. It's less fun talking about what we all already agree with, so it's much more enjoyable actually pushing into the debates and then seeing what we can each discover new about each other's paradigms and opinions. So let me begin by saying what we do not dispute in the state capacity literature. We do not dispute the basic empirical findings. As far as we can tell, those are sound. We do not dispute the obvious historical record that you did not get takeoff economic growth until you had strong, coherent, centralized, yet restrained states. We're not disputing that, not in the least. We're simply saying we need to think a little bit more carefully about what constitutes an explanation in the social sciences and how state capacity relates to that. All those empirical measures are very important. Being able to collect tax revenue with minimum excess burden, being able to provide a uniform rule of law that acts on individuals rather than groups according to honor or status. These are absolutely inescapably essential things for modern economic growth. But again, until we understand the backdrop of the state-building process that gave us those things, we are going to miss something important for arriving at that explanation. And it's important to recognize that early modern state-building was a project largely done by elites for elites. So if you're going to tell me that state capacity is the proximate cause of liberalism and the Great Enlightenment, Great Enrichment, you are also saying that centralized, coherent political power, right, the ability to wield coercive force, which is at the end of the day what political power is, is responsible for what is arguably the single most remarkable transformation in the welfare of millions, if not billions, of people that has ever happened in world history. That's a little bit difficult for us to swallow because we have so many counterexamples of raw political power being used to do really, really awful things to people. You can use political power to make productive and protective investments. By that we mean provide public goods, protect property rights, do things like that. But much more common in human history is political power being wielded in a predatory fashion. Me and my gang of elites are going to come over to your homestead, to your territory, to your city, and take your stuff. So insofar as there was a categorical change in how political power was used, starting in early modernity and really culminating in the Enlightenment, we need to explain why political power was used protectively and productively, but was not used predatorily. Many state capacity theorists will acknowledge this. They say that's what the Constitution is for. In which case we respond, then the Constitution is the mechanism. And without the Constitution, state capacity is really more of a story about institutional morphology rather than a causal story about why political power was wielded in the necessary and sufficient ways to give us widespread wealth. It's primarily an issue of interpretation and emphasis. Again, we don't dispute the state capacity findings because we don't actually engage in the kind of conventional quantitative empirical analysis that establishes, hey, we can look at tax revenues over GDP and see something important is happening here, or the coherence of legal codes and see that something is happening there. That's all great. That needs to be part of the story. It's about what's in the analytical foreground and what's in the analytical background. We think the Constitution, the thing that makes political power used responsibly by elites, that has to be the main thing we focus on. And if you're going to explain the Constitution sometime between 1550 and 1750, you need to explain the constitutional bargaining process that got us there, which is why you have to go back to medieval Europe. It's the antecedent. Right, we always think about exchange as proceeding from a given distribution of endowments, and then we talk about how movements along the contract curve give us to a new equilibrium. We're doing the same thing. There's an initial distribution of political power amongst the relevant exchangers. We move along the constitutional contract curve commensurate with those endowments and opportunities for mutually beneficial exchange. And so we think that we need to characterize the constitutional equilibrium for the state capacity story to even make sense.
So in the traditional discussion of the literature that more or less, I would say, stresses that in order for the state to be constrained, it needs first to be a state, would you think that we should focus more on the process of constructing the state and constraining it at the same time?
I think that we have to, because the process by which the state was constrained and the process by which the state became the state are the same process. The state building is arguably the intended outcome. We can all understand why traditional elites would want a nice, big, bold, powerful state to be in charge of. They're probably less excited by the constraints, and yet the constraints develop at the same time, not necessarily identically to various expansions of authority. We can also always talk about, you know, early modern princes, would-be absolute sovereigns outrunning constraints on their government, right? But the broad constitutional process was occurring commensurate with the centralization and coherence of political authority. Obviously, one presupposes the other, and talking about one feature, the state, you're also talking about what constrains the state. For us, it's a matter of emphasis and interpretation, especially because one of these things you can understand why elites wanted, whereas the other one, they probably would not have been as happy about. They probably would have been willing to accept it in exchange for the increases in their formal powers, right? You can voluntarily choose to be constrained in a way that benefits you. But nonetheless, you would rather not be constrained. You would often rather not be constrained. And so understanding how the constraints came about, understanding the constraints as a part of a rational constitutional bargaining process is very important. And this is something that constitutional scholars have recognized for a while. One of the simple models that we emphasize in the book is the king and council model. Popular by Roger Congleton in his book Perfecting Parliament. Understanding why a rational monarch or why a rational autocrat would want to be constrained in some circumstances is an important part of this process. So yes, before the state can be constrained, it needs to be a state, but before the state can be built, the various parties to the state building process need credible assurance that once that agglomeration of power is constructed, it won't be wielded against them. So you can't necessarily say that states precede the constraints upon them. Constitutionally, we think it makes more sense to say that the constrained bargains yielded the state.
You agree or disagree with the idea that at the end of the day, the liberal state, the constrained state, is nonetheless kind of the optimal outcome that humanity, social societies arrive to? Or do you think that polycentric shareholder society could exist that is different from the current world of our nation states?
Perhaps it could. We don't see the likelihood of that recurring anytime soon, nor are we particularly eager for that. I would classify liberal states as optimal in the sense that they are descriptively efficient. I think that that means that given the constraints on the constitutional bargaining process, what we have represents, again, a constrained maximum. There are governance problems with contemporary states. There are many things that I'm not wild about with modern governance. That's very different than saying, and therefore we should all go back to something like medieval Europe. I mean, think about it. If you would rather live in a developed Western nation today or some territory in Western Europe in the high Middle Ages, that one's pretty easy. I think that one's pretty easy. I would pick today. At the same time, it's interesting to think about maybe some radical institutional possibilities, a world of, I don't know, very decentralized, privately owned and operated city-states in confederation with each other, contractually providing governance services. I think that that's a very interesting thought experiment. But in terms of actually getting there, it would require such massive and uncertain political changes that I, for one, would be hesitant to call for such a thing. So while I still think that, let me put it this way, there's no such thing as the end of history. What we have now is very good. We can always hope it's going to be better. We should work towards better by encouraging innovation at the margin rather than pulling the rug out from under the existing sociopolitical order and hoping that if we rebuild it anew, we'll get some. I don't think that that's going to work very well if we try it.
So I would like to conclude on a similar note and asking your perspectives on the modern world specifically. Now, you already said that you do not want it, but nonetheless, I would like to ask, do you see any possibility or potential for a return to a more optimal polycentric layered and multi-hierarchical governance system? Because, I don't know, in the 80s, there was this cyberpunk genre which more or less portrayed the idea as an obvious outcome of basically capitalism or free markets with a largely negative perspective in which the world would be run by a competing large corporations. And there's a lot of similitudes in the way some historians see the medieval world in the sense of guilds competing, but not competing in a free way, but competing in a nepotistic way, which basically you run through privileges and favors rather than through prices and such on. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the guild system is fascinating. We could do an entire podcast on that. But limiting it to your question, which really is a good one and an interesting one, personally, yes, I would like to see more decentralization and more private governance in the contemporary governance landscape. At the same time, that's a different question than do I think that we're going to actually get that? Are forces pushing us in that direction? Is the ongoing process of constitutional exchange going to give us a more decentralized, more polycentric, more privately governed world? My answer to that is, well, first of all, I don't know. But second of all, if you pushed me and forced me to pick one, I would say no. I don't think the governance arrangements are becoming more polycentric, more overlapping, more fragmented, more concurrent, more privatized. I think that the nation state is here to stay. I think it's going to be around for the foreseeable future. And even if it doesn't work in many ways as well as I would like in my ideal world, we should be hesitant about radically changing basic institutional frameworks. There might be room at the margin for renovations and revitalizations of federalism. There's certainly room at the margin for experimenting with more private and voluntary bottom-up forms of governance. But again, the nation state is still going to be there. And if it's still the nation state, any institutional innovation and experimentation is going to take place with, at minimum, its tacit permission. I don't see that changing anytime soon. Perfectly fine to try and find ways to make contemporary governance work better. I would be less eager to try to re-engineer something like the High Middle Ages. I think it's important to understand where we came from. I think that we owe a debt to the High Middle Ages and the various political patrimony that we've inherited, the various religious and cultural traditions that we've inherited. But we got it from there to here for a reason. That reason is the constitutional bargaining process structured political exchange such that the end results of that was modern nation states. And as long as the economies of scale with bundling contiguous territory with overwhelming physical force remain what they are, I just don't see any alternative for the foreseeable future.
Well, thank you for your time, Alexei. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Fernando, thank you. This was very, very enjoyable.
The profound economic growth in Western Europe during the 17th to 19th centuries cannot be explained without acknowledging the ascent of the liberal state as a central force. Scholars have long debated its emergence and limitations, yet one aspect has been often overlooked: comprehending its roots in a decentralized medieval society, where the state institutions were initially established. That is, we need to pay attention to the medieval constitution of liberty. This has been Penn's Exchange, Markets and Cooperation, a podcast from the Penn Initiative for the Study of Markets at the University of Pennsylvania's Economics Department. Our goal is to bring a thoughtful, fact-based, and entertaining discussion on the historical experience of markets and their philosophical foundations. I am Fernando Arteaga, and I will be glad to hear from you. You can follow us on Instagram and on Twitter as @Penn_Exchange. Stay tuned.